The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Reach.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi and Cantor David Cain, who recently returned from Germany, where he attended ceremonies commemorating the 65th anniversary of the liberation of the concentration camp in which he was imprisoned during the Holocaust. We'll also have a visit from our Mevina on Jewish ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Letterman, storyteller Jordan Hill, and our expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom! Summer will be here officially next week, but it's already hot, which means it's time to think about summer pursuits like vacations and, of course, everybody's favorite, summer camp, which gives me an excuse to play one of the true classics of 20th century music, the immortal Alan Sherman's Beyond the Summer Camp Experience. Hello, Mada. Hello, Fada.
Hello, Mada. Hello, Fada. Here I am at Camp Granada. Camp is very entertaining, and they say we'll have some fun if it stops raining. I went hiking with Joe Spivey. He developed poison ivy. You remember Leonard Skinner? He got ptomaine poisoning last night after dinner. All the counselors hate the waiters, and the lake has alligators, and the head coach wants no sissies, so he reads to us from something called Ulysses. Now I don't want this should scare you, but my bunkmate has malaria. You remember Jeffrey Hardy? They're about to organize a searching party. Take me home, oh Mada Fada, take me home. I hate Granada, don't leave me out in the forest where I might get eaten by a bear. Take me home, I promise I will not make noise or mess the house with other boys. Oh, please don't make me stay. I've been here one whole day. Dearest Fada, darling Mada, how's my precious little brother? Let me come home if you miss me. I would even let Aunt Bertha hug and kiss me. Wait a minute, it stopped hailing. Guys are swimming, guys are sailing, playing baseball, gee, that's better. Mada Fada, kindly disregard this letter.
I've always loved that cut in a slightly over-the-top way. It is, of course, very funny and human and appropriate for this time of year, while with kids getting ready to go away to what we used to call sleepaway camp, and parents getting ready to enjoy life again. To miss our sweet, lovely children every day they are gone. The truth is that with the cost of overnight camps these days, what parents may find themselves missing most is financial solvency. I have three children at a Jewish camp this year in Malibu. Oof, wasn't really that expensive. I just had to sell the car to pay for it, and we'll be serving pasta quite a lot this coming year at my house, but it's all worth it. Truth is, it is worth it, because when kids attend a Jewish camp, they come back with an extraordinarily natural feeling about what it's like to live Jewishly every day, without a thought of protesting or criticizing the experiences not being mainstream enough. At camp, being Jewish is completely cool, the way it should seem in everyday life and at the synagogue, but often doesn't. If we could introduce all of our children to a total Jewish environment like camp and make it a regular part of their lives the rest of the year, we would make enormous progress towards ensuring the future of the American Jewish community for the next generation and generations to come. But you know, sometimes we are able to replicate that kind of dedicated, embracing Jewish experience, not only for kids, but for adults and families and seniors, in both our own homes and in our temples. When we can do that, we begin to create the kind of future for Judaism that is essential to our continued flourishing in this remarkable country. For Judaism wasn't made to be experienced in tiny bits and only in the synagogue. Judaism is a way of life, as my grandfather, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan, called it in his book of that same title. As a way of life, it is meant to include experiences and insights that enter every area of human endeavor. When we have a temple retreat or an Israel trip or an extended study session or a year-long class like Adult B'nai Mitzvah or Adult Confirmation, we're also trying to create a kind of Jewish camp experience for grown-ups. It's when we make Judaism a part of every part of our lives that we gain the greatest sense of God's goodness and the holiness and serenity that Judaism can bring to us. So this summer, send your kids or grandchildren to Jewish camp, but take some time to include beautiful Jewish rituals and study and play in your own life every day, too. To play us in a little more this morning, here's a wonderful and very suggestive Sephardic song, Avre tu puerta cerrada. Open up your closed door, my darling.
Avre tu puerta cerrada, que en tu balcón luz no hay. El amor a ti te dela. Partemos, Rosa, partemos de aquí. Hermosura como te la dio el Dios. La hermosura tuya es pura, la merezco solo yo. Abre tu puerta cerrada, que en tu balcón luz no hay. El amor a ti te vela. Partemos, Rosa, partemos de aquí. Partemos, Rosa, partemos de aquí.
The Sephardic song, Avre tu puerta cerrada. Open your locked door, or at least your closed door, honey. When we come back on Too Jewish this morning, our guest will be an old friend, Rabbi and cantor Dave Kane, a Holocaust survivor who recently returned from a visit to Germany for the 65th anniversary of his liberation at the concentration camp. Find out about that powerful experience when we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning.
In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Chardonnay Shabbat is here. Friday night services were never this fun before. It's a loaf of good bread, a jug of excellent wine, and you, and a delightful way to begin your weekend with Sabbath fun and friendship at Temple Emmanuel during our summer Chardonnay Shabbat evenings. Join us for Chardonnay Shabbat at Temple Emmanuel every Friday night this summer. We start with a wine, cheese, and fruit pre-owned egg Shabbat reception at 5 p.m., followed by a fun, musical one-hour Sabbath service at 5:45. Celebrate summer with Chardonnay Shabbat. There's no charge or obligation. Just a lovely way to begin the weekend at Temple Emmanuel. Temple Emmanuel is centrally located at 225 North Country Club Road between Broadway and 5th. Call 520-327-4501 for more information. That's 327-4501. Or visit our website at templeemmanueltucson.org and join us on Friday nights for Chardonnay Shabbat.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our old friend, Rabbi and cantor David Kane. Dave Kane is a survivor of three concentration camps who was liberated from Buchenwald and just returned to Germany for the 65th anniversary of that liberation recently. We'll talk about that. Came to the U.S. in May of 1949. In the U.S., he served in the U.S. Army during the Korean War and graduated from L.A. City College in Cal State, L.A., went on to Chapman College and continued his studies and worked as a chazan, a cantor for such a long time that he's still working as a cantor in the Los Angeles area. A remarkable singer, he also received rabbinic ordination. He's the chazan emeritus of Temple Beth Sholem of Long Beach. And again, just recently returned from Germany. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning. How are you, Rabbi?
I'm well. I have to admit, in the interest of full disclosure, that I think one of the first jobs I ever had was when you needed me to fill in reading Torah for you one Shabbos and cantor when you had laryngitis a long time ago now. You just recently came back from Germany. You were
right.
Liberated from Buchenwald in 1945, April of 45. Tell us a little bit about what it was like to go back there now for the 65th anniversary.
Well, it was very, very interesting because about, you know, when the we came to the program as far as the observance of the 65th year of Buchenwald being freed by the American Army, there were about almost 2,000 German people, all kinds of people, the liberators. There were some of the liberators that came to this observance. And the whole Buchenwald was really, as we say, the barracks were demolished. And all you can see there is little black pebbles and gray pebbles, which the prisoners worked on. And the main camp of Buchenwald, there is a monument of the crematorium, which stood right in the middle with the ashes from those that they murdered underneath. But the guardhouse is the same, and one of the streets is called Blutstrasse, which means Blood Street. And I stayed in the Elephant Hotel, so they wrote me that all kinds of heads of states and stars slept there. Supposed to be five-star hotel and everything, and that even Hitler slept there at one time.
Hmm.
Well, you know, with me, that went very far.
Oh,
so
yeah, sure.
I told him, well, that's all right. Hitler is not here anymore. He's dead. I'm alive.
It's a powerful statement. We will talk much more extensively with Rabbi and Chazan Dave Kane when we come back here on Too Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com. We want to see that mailbox full, preferably with nice comments. Or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can also get CDs of past and present shows by contacting us through the website or downloading us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as podcasts. We welcome our Mivinar expert on Jewish ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Letterman. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about kashrut and whether it's moral or ritual, and we've come to the conclusion, I think it is really an attempt at creating an ethic of eating. You started on the subject just barely of echo kashrut last week, mentioning Reb Zalman Schechter Shlomia, an old friend, and his concept that being kosher should mean something that's environmentally good.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating, I think, evolution in the notion of kashrut, which we talked about last week as really meaning fit for consumption. His sense of consumption expanded beyond food to clothing, goods, resources, based on both the way we treat the people involved in providing the clothing, food, etc., for our consumption, and the environmental considerations. It was really quite a novel concept back in the 70s when he began to talk about this, to include or embrace ecological, environmental dimensions in the determination of what is kosher or fit for our use. And, you know, we've seen a lot of things happen over time. I mentioned in another program that there have been abuses that occurred in the kosher meat industry, and a response that came actually from the conservative movement, and I'd like to talk to you a little bit about what the reform movement's doing,
sure. Is
working to implement a new form of a heksher tzedek, kosher certification.
In fact, I interviewed the guy on Too Jewish about that very subject, and we followed that whole agriprocessor's mess in the last couple of years.
Exactly. So it's not that it replaces the traditional kosher certification. It actually adds another layer to it, that social justice, how we treat the people who work in the factories, how we deal with the ecological byproducts, all those things should be an element of kashrut certification. And I think, you know, it's a wonderful idea to think that Jewish identity would think about what is it, what do I have to do, and what moral component do I have when I eat, shop, purchase, distribute. I mean, it's really not just a relative concept. It's a very totally all-encompassing concept that comes from kashrut. And I'm interested, Rabbi, to ask what Temple Emmanuel and your congregation's approach to this is.
You know, it's a great question. In terms of kashrut in general, you know, most Reform congregations are not kosher, don't have a kosher kitchen per se. We do have a policy that's evolved over the time I've been there. I've been there 11 years now, of not having any non-kosher meat, no shellfish, no pork, and not mixing milk and meat in any of the events that are officially held under Temple's auspices. Do people sometimes bring stuff into the kitchen that we don't know about? We don't really have two sets of dishes per se, but we use glass, so that helps. In terms of eco kashrut, we really do try to buy renewable sources, but I wouldn't say it's a systematic approach. And the kosher meat we buy, we stopped buying Raboshkin's stuff as soon as it became clear that it wasn't produced ethically. But, you know, it's not clear exactly what Eko Kosher will ultimately mean for us.
And does it continue to be a board process, a discussion, or is it pretty much...
I call it stealth kashrut.
Oh, interesting.
In a conservative congregation, it's going to be a big public issue. In a reformed congregation that used to be conservative, I served one of those once, it's a public issue. In some reformed congregations, one of the things they say is, we're not kosher, we're reform.
Uh-huh.
We're not in that position. But I think people don't make it a big deal. But we try to make sure that everybody, within reason, can eat in our synagogue.
That's wonderful.
Thanks, Amy. We will talk next week.
It's my pleasure, and have a great weekend.
Thank you. When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, from Two Jewish Storyteller Jordan Hill, and get the Old Jewish Joke of the Week. We visit weekly with the outstanding restaurateur, Janos Wadler of Janos Restaurant at the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Janos is the finest restaurant in the Southwest. J-Bar are the most fun in all of the Southwest, I'd say, but they're also great places to hear music in the summer.
I think that's one of the things that makes J-Bar and Janos so fun in the summer is the Summer Music Series. We have music every Wednesday and Thursday night out under the stars, and it's a really busy time, a really fun time for us, and great musicians, local musicians, but local musicians who also tour all around the world, and we get them at J-Bar.
You can sit outside, look at the stars, eat great food, have a drink, and just enjoy the summer with the Summer Music Series at Janos and the J-Bar.
And I'll see you there, Rabbi. Give us a call, 615-6100, and we'll have your table ready for you out under the stars listening to the music.
And eating and drinking. What's the website?
www.janos.com. The full summer music schedule's on the web.
JNOS.com. Thanks, Janos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We have been touring Italy, talking about places you can go on your summer vacation and that have an interesting Jewish component, a very important Jewish component. You know, I was remembering coming out of the synagogue in Venice, having gone to services there on a Friday night, struck up a conversation with a woman. She was from Bologna. And I said, oh, are you Sephardic or Ashkenazic? And she said, no, we're like, you know, Italian Jews, Nusach Roma, meaning originally from Rome. And that means predating the division between Sephardim and Ashkenazim, and yet some of her family had married Sephardim and some had married Ashkenazim, and here she was from this very small Jewish area now with a tremendous history. That is really unusual. I guess to me, Italy is kind of the Jewish melting pot in some ways, long before it became a place like America. You know, Jews went there from fleeing the Inquisition. Jews went there from everywhere in the Jewish world at various times, even though the church was located there.
Right. In fact, one of the Borgia popes, one of the infamous popes who actually unwittingly caused the Protestant Reformation, welcomed the Jews who'd been expelled from Spain in 1492 against the wishes of the established Roman Jewish community, which didn't want these poor, starving, ragged, jobless Jews, because they felt they would have to take care of them. And actually, the Pope insisted that they come. And there was a tradition in the Middle Ages, which was upheld by good popes and bad, of defending the Jews because of St. Augustine's doctrine of witness. So this particular Pope, who was otherwise a pretty bad guy, was responsible for, at one stroke of a pen, tripling the size of the Roman Jewish community. And ultimately probably making it what it is today. I wanted to sort of continue our sweep southward. We started in the north, The next big city, and one with a very interesting Jewish history, is a city that most Americans are wrongly afraid to visit, and that's Naples, Napoli in Italian. It has, you know, the beautiful bay from which you can see the Isles of Capri and Ischia and whatever. And there's this phrase, I think, see Naples and die. It yeah. is a very beautiful city, has incredible art museums. It has probably not as many antiquities to see as Rome, in the sense of it doesn't have a Colosseum. It has probably more in the way of art museums and palaces and really splendid monuments. And because it was for so many centuries not part of Italy, but part of either France or Spain or the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies or whatever.
Kingdom of Naples at times itself. Right?
It has a very different, distinct Jewish history. And it was a great commercial and mercantile center. So, of course, Jews in the Middle Ages played a big role in the history of Naples. And it's a city well worth visiting for many reasons, not least of which is it's the hometown of pizza. So any American who really likes pizza ought to go and try once in his or her life real Neapolitan pizza in the place where it was actually invented.
And, you know, maybe we can just say it was invented by Jews to give you an extra incentive to go to Naples and try the pizza.
You can say it. I'm not sure there's any research to bear that out, though.
Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
Look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Peter, a tourist wandering through the Sinai Desert, gets lost and very soon is tired and desperate for water. Just as he's about to give up hope, he sees a tiny oasis in the distance. Relieved, he heads for it. When he gets there, he's astonished to see a sign saying, Moshe's Tie Warehouse. And sitting there under a palm tree is Moshe himself, reading the Jerusalem Post. Next to him is a table showing dozens of different kinds of silk ties. Peter asks Moshe for some water, but Moshe says, I'm sorry, I don't have any water, but would you like to buy a tie? Peter says, what good is a tie going to do me in the Sinai Desert? I need water. You can stuff your fancy ties. Moshe says, look, it's no good being rude. If you don't want a tie, you don't buy a tie. You're making a mistake, but it's your choice. Peter says, thanks for the advice. Thanks for nothing, but do you know where I can get some water? I'm very thirsty. Moshe answers, well, I don't have any water for you, but if you walk in that direction about 30 minutes, you'll come to a restaurant. It's owned by my brother Max. There you can get plenty of food and water. Peter starts walking and soon disappears over the sand dunes. Moshe continues to read his paper. An hour later, Peter crawls up to Moshe's tie warehouse on his hands and knees. He's desperate for water, practically on his last breath. Moshe asks, so what happened? Didn't you find Max's restaurant? Oh, I found the restaurant all right, gasped Peter. But Max wouldn't let me in without a tie. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and dress appropriately. We welcome our Too Jewish storyteller, Jordan Hill. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, Rabbi. This story collected by Yitzchak Bachsbaum is about a rabbi that was not just clever, but wise, and a wonderful storyteller. The great rabbi who I've told stories before on the show about, the Baal Shem Tov. And at the time of the Baal Shem Tov, he was doing this whole Jewish revival, trying to get people to celebrate and dance and tell stories, compared to the mainstream of Judaism then, which was very, very rigid and legalistic. And one day, there was this one very, very legalistic rabbi who had heard stories of the Baal Shem Tov and thought that this guy must be some sort of quack, and he didn't want anything to do with him. And the Baal Shem Tov had also heard of this rabbi who was a great Torah scholar, and he wanted to work with this guy, and so the Baal Shem Tov had an idea. He rode his horse into town with a small wagon early, early in the morning, just when people were getting up. And as the first man entered into the town square, the Baal Shem Tov pulled him inside and said, my friend, I wish to tell you a story. And before you know it, the man was transfixed with the story that the Besht was telling, the Baal Shem Tov was saying. And one person after another person got stuck into this web of enchantment that the Besht was able to weave, until soon almost everyone in the town was listening to the story, including the man who had the keys to the shul, the one who would open the door for the early morning minyan. Well, the stories went on and on and on, and suddenly that man with the keys, he remembered his duty, and he went running back to the shul, but he knew it was too late. There was the rabbi pacing back and forth in front of the synagogue door, and he glared at that man with the keys and said, "What were you doing?" And when the man admitted that there was this man in town who was telling all these stories, well, the rabbi insisted that after tefillah, after the prayers, that this man, the stranger, be brought to him. And so it was that after the prayers were done, that servant went over to the town square where the Baal Shem Tov was just finishing up and invited him to come and see the rabbi. So the Baal Shem Tov followed, went into the study of the rabbi, and the rabbi glared at him and he said, "So you were the one distracting my people, keeping them from services this morning." And the Baal Shem Tov said, "I must admit that it was me." And the man said, "Well, explain yourself." And the Baal Shem Tov said, "Okay, I'll tell you a story." And he started telling him the story, and the rabbi was so captivated that after the Baal Shem Tov was done, he said, "Sir, could I tell you another story?" And the rabbi, who had suddenly found respect for the stranger, said, "Well, yes, sir, you can." So the Baal Shem Tov told him one more story. And this time the man was even more captivated. And when he was done, the Baal Shem Tov looked at him and he said, "I will tell you another story." And the rabbi, realizing the true order of things, looked at the stranger and said, "Yes, master." And so the Baal Shem Tov said, "I once had a horse, and I was riding him, and he wouldn't make a noise. And suddenly a peasant looked and said, 'You see, you've got the reins on too tight. Let them loose, and your horse will speak again.'" And the Baal Shem Tov said, "Rabbi, that story is about you. Do you understand?" And the rabbi nodded, and he said, "Yes, master." And he became one of the foremost disciples of the Baal Shem Tov.
Thanks, Jordan. We'll get another story next week. And now a word of Torah. This week in the Book of Numbers, we read the odd ritualistic Torah portion of Chukat, the rites of the red heifer. In order to achieve true ritual purity, ancient Jews were required to find a completely unblemished young red female cow, slaughter it, burn it to ash, and mix the ashes with water to create a water of purification in which to wash away ritual impurity. While many elements in the sacrificial code of our ancestors seem odd or alien, this could be the strangest of all the rituals. For it turns out that the red heifer, the Parah Adumah, makes the one who is washed in its ash water pure, but it makes everyone else who comes into contact with it impure. The mystery is rather complete. Commentators have struggled with its meaning ever since the time the Torah was given. Just what is it that makes the red heifer the right animal to bring purity to the people? And why does it make you pure if you use it properly, but impure while you are preparing it? The classic answer to the first question is that God ordains the use of a red heifer as a symbolic reversal for the episode of the golden calf. If the people sinned by praying to an idol of a calf, then the very real slaughter and burning of an actual cow and the use of its ashes might atone for that transgression. You know, a calf for a cow or a cow for a calf. But still, why should the process of making something that cleanses us ritually make us unclean? Perhaps the answer is also symbolic. The process of bringing holiness into our world is never easy. Working in the field of holiness creation is a complex task. When you toil in the vineyards of the Lord, there's a tendency for the muck that always exists to attach itself to you. When we seek to bring purity into the lives of others, we stand a good chance of exchanging some of our own sanctity for a bit of the grime that stubbornly persists in most people's daily existence. Perhaps a sacred cow like the red heifer symbolizes the way in which we can only bring holiness and purity at a price. When we acknowledge that price, accept it, and learn to cleanse others ritually afterwards, we will replenish our ability to help and heal others. When we come back on Two Jewish in a few moments, we'll get the news of Jews around the world and find out what it feels like to go back to the concentration camp you were interned in 65 years after you're liberated, from Rabbi and Cantor Dave Kane. All that when we come back on Two Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side.
That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The United Nations Security Council passed new sanctions against Iran, setting the stage for new and tougher U.S. sanctions. The vote this week was a victory for U.S.-led efforts to garner international support for isolating the regime until it makes its nuclear program transparent. Key to passage was the support of China and Russia. The resolution expands existing sanctions and creates a basis in international law for nations to target Iran's energy and banking sectors. That sets the stage for the U.S. Congress to pass sanctions that would target third-party entities, companies, individuals, and states that deal with Iran's energy sector. U.S. Representative Howard Berman, Democrat of California, the chairman of the House of Representatives Foreign Affairs Committee, and a lead sponsor of the expanded sanctions legislation, said it would pass Congress by the end of the month. Berman called on other nations to do the same. Of the Council's 15 members, 12 voted in support, Turkey and Brazil voted against, Lebanon abstained. In other news, President Obama said the situation in the Gaza Strip was unsustainable and that he'd budget an additional $400 million to improve conditions there and in the West Bank. Obama and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas met in Washington last week and discussed the aftermath of Israel's deadly raid last week on a Turkish-flagged ship ferrying aid and activists to Gaza Strip in order to break Israel's blockade of the Strip. Israel maintains the blockade is to keep weapons out of the hands of Gaza's Hamas rulers and also to squeeze Gazans into withdrawing support for the terrorist group. The United States currently supplies about $500 million in assistance to the Palestinians. Any funds dispersed in Gaza are administered through non-governmental organizations vetted for any ties with Hamas. And the fallout from the situation over Israel stopping the so-called flotilla 2 weeks ago spread to the White House, or at least the White House press corps. Helen Thomas, the opinionated White House correspondent, lost her storied perch in presidential press conferences in a flap over calling on Israel to get out of Palestine. Thomas, 89, abruptly retired as a columnist for Hearst News Service. The announcement, in a terse statement by Hearst, came after videotaped remarks she made to an independent filmmaker about Israel spread virally through the internet. Her retirement was set in motion by a website, rabbilive.com, that relaunched only last week after having previously existed to beam religious services to military personnel in Iraq and Afghanistan. Rabbi David Nesanoff, an independent filmmaker for Long Island who runs the website, said he approached Thomas outside the White House after being there for Jewish Heritage Day on May 27th. He asked whether she had any comments on Israel. "Tell them to get the hell out of Palestine," she replied. "Remember, these people are occupied and it's their land. It's not Germany, it's not Poland," she continued. Asked where they should go, she answered, "They should go home." "Where's home?" Nesanoff asked. "Poland, Germany, and America, and everywhere else," Thomas replied. "Perhaps she wants 7 million Israelis to all move to Auschwitz. I understand the barracks there are unoccupied at present." Helen Thomas had been scheduled to speak tomorrow at the graduation of Walt Whitman High School in the Washington suburb of Bethesda, Maryland. But Principal Alan Goodwin wrote in an email to students and parents that she was being replaced. Writing on her website, Thomas said, "I deeply regret my comments I made last week regarding the Israelis and the Palestinians." She added, "They do not reflect my heartfelt belief that peace will come to the Middle East only when all parties recognize the need for mutual respect and tolerance. May that day come soon," she said. Helen Thomas's resignation is probably long past due and was necessary. But how many other journalists have said horrible, inaccurate, insulting, and anti-Semitic things about Israel recently and faced no consequences at all? And that's news of Jews around the world.
We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish, an old and close friend of my own and my father's, rabbi and cantor Dave Kane. He was born in Bzin, Poland in 1928. A survivor of the Holocaust, he was sent to a variety of concentration camps, including Auschwitz, Majdanek, and Buchenwald. The American Army liberated Dave from Buchenwald in April of 1945. He eventually came to the U.S. in May of 1949, recently returned from Germany, where he was present for the 65th anniversary ceremonies of the liberation of Buchenwald. Dave, I'll ask you to talk about something that I'm sure was painful. The war broke out when you were 11 years old, actually, or so. Tell me a little bit about your experiences at the start of the war and how you ended up in the camps.
Well, to tell you that when they came in 1939, within 1 week, the Jewish people suffered by having to put on the yellow armband with a star, a Jewish star, with the word Yude, Jew. And in just a few months, they closed up all the shops that were owned by the Jewish people, by our people. Bzin was a town where there were 60,000 Jews and about, I would say, between 30 and 60,000 non-Jews. It was not a big town, but we had our own streetcars. We had a railroad station. There was a police station. There was a hospital. A regular town. By the end of 1939, we were all shipped out to a ghetto from our homes. And my father and I, who stayed in the ghetto, survived the ghetto, had to go and clean out all the dwellings and put it in the yards, and the Germans confiscated a lot of everything that was owned by our people. And then it's a long story. From there, my father and I got out, and we tried to run to Hungary. We had people who hit us and wound up in Hungary for 4 months. But eventually, from Hungary, we're shipped back to Auschwitz. And Auschwitz, we were just there a couple of few days, and then to Majdanek, and within 2 or 3 weeks we're shipped to Kittlitz-Treben. And Kittlitz-Treben, we were there till the Russians started coming close, and they took us on a march to Buchenwald. And we came to Buchenwald, I'd say somewhere towards the end of 1944, and were liberated April 11, 1945. Of course, death was everywhere. The wire, electric wire fence and everything, and I just feel that it was God's will that my father and I survived. I lost my mother, my sister, and my aunts and uncles, a big family, of which my father and I survived, and aunt of mine who went to Israel and lived in Israel till a couple of years ago when she expired. She passed away. My father passed away at the age of 82. And so, after seeing the 81 former prisoners of Buchenwald that came to this observance, and some of the liberators and everything else, I consider myself and my wife the richest people in the world, because a lot of these people have been liberated and are here physically, but mentally they never left Buchenwald. And their philosophy and life and everything is such that it left a very, very big, big mark of sorrow and unhappiness in their daily life.
You know, I think of some other famous people who were imprisoned in Buchenwald, like Elie Wiesel. How many members of your family died in the Holocaust, Dave?
Oh, I'd say probably about 60, 70.
How is it that you don't feel that level of imprisonment that some of the other people do?
Well, I feel that I was very fortunate in coming to the United States, one of the greatest countries in the world, no matter what people say and no matter what happens. This is the country of freedom and liberty and possibility of growth other than any country I've been in. And I feel that life is here for the living. If I concentrate on the sorrow and the suffering that I went through, I would not have too much of a life. My children, my wife and I, had the privilege of having three children, my daughter and two sons. And when they were very, very young, we never talked about the Holocaust to them, because we wanted them to grow up without the fear and without the abnormalcy of the Holocaust. And we started speaking Yiddish to them. And then after they were 5 years old, we switched to both Yiddish and English. And only when they were old enough for them to know and for them to ask did we talk to them about it. And I feel that every day that we're on this earth is a time that God gives us, like we say, Zehayom Asa Adonai Nagila V'Nismachavo.
Right.
You should rejoice in the day that you're alive, because we don't know when God will recall us to his eternal abode. So why go around and not give someone else a smile, a good word, encouragement, and live on? Because we can never forget that, never. So, I was asked the question, can you forget and forgive? And my answer is, I cannot forget and I cannot forgive, but I cannot at the same time hold it within my heart to stay and be able to assume that kind of pain. I mean, it's I hope you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I want to ask a different question. You know, you were just back in Germany for this experience. You knew Germans in a very different context during the war and even after the war.
Right.
What was your experience of this generation of Germans?
Well, they're very apologetic. They feel a guilt, and they also admit the guilt. You know, many Germans after the war in 45, they say, "Oh, we didn't know anything about that. We didn't see anything. Oh, we heard something," but nobody really was apologetic, and, you know, admitted to some guilt. Whereas now, this was not the case. The people that I met, they called me Herr Rabbina, Sir Rabbi. It's my honor to serve you. It's my honor to be of help to you. We are very happy that you are here. Thank you for coming. I mean, the politeness was almost sickening.
It's quite a difference, isn't it?
It is. It is a great difference. And, you know, if you meet a person who is 45 or 50 or even 60, you cannot say that it is your fault. But they feel the pain that their grandparents or parents had something to do with it. And they're trying to do everything to do that. Like they asked me, one person once said, well, you get paid the reparations, Israel got so much money. So my answer was, listen, if somebody kills your mother or your father or your brother or your sister or any member of your family, is there an amount that is sufficient to pay for that sorrow?
Dave,
I mean, how can you forgive?
One more question. I mean, you have a wonderful wife, Yetta. You've been married more than half a century. You have 3 children, 6 grandchildren, successful children.
And with God's help, 1 great-grandchild.
Thank God. It will come a time in the not terribly distant future when there won't be any more survivors walking around. May it be many years from now, but time does this to all of us. What message would you most like to convey?
This is why we did go to Germany, to show them that survivors are still here and to put the onus on the Germans today. Like, I'm going to speak to a high school with my wife tomorrow. And one of the last messages that I give them, I'm here to tell you about my survival, our survival, and to let you know that this was the truth. Some people say that this is a made-up story or whatever. So to tell you that one day, when we are no longer here, there'll just be films and books. And so I want you to know that I'm glad to tell you about it. But at the same time, I'm going to put the onus on you people, because you witnessed me speaking to you, and you witnessed and know about what was. And so you are responsible to carry on. Like a friend of mine who has the Zachor Foundation he created. Zachor, remember. And he got some pins that one of these days I'll see that you get one.
Okay.
And to remember. So I'm putting the onus not just on the German people, but on our people, the Jewish people, on every walking human being, to know that when we say, and you say it, I'm sure, all the time, Lo yisa goy el goy cherev v'lo yomedu od milchama, that nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall men learn war anymore. Because you, your father, God bless him, your family, always thought that there should be peace in this world and mankind should be human-like to one another, because we cannot forget, because if it happened, God forbid, that men should do things like they did from 1939 till 1945.
Dave, thank you for a great visit on Two Jewish. May your words come true.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Two Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest for Father's Day will be Bruce Feiler, author of Walking the Bible, but most importantly, author of the wonderful new book, The Council of Dads. Don't miss it. Our playout this morning comes from the American Jewish pop singer Todd Herzog and his tune Eitz Chaim Hi, Tree of Life. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.
It was planted by my grandpa in his wisdom and his forethought to provide shade and protection for our family. As he finished with his toil, he looked up at me from the soil, and I never will forget the words he said to me. If you hold on tight to this tree of life, you will lead a life of justice and integrity. If you learn to see, it will set you free, and the more you give, the more you will receive. Hold on to the tree.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.